Atlanta. It's a freezing cold day here in Atlanta. I don't even know what day it is. January 8th, 2014. Time flies when you're having fun. It's going to be a good show today. I have a really great guest. Joey Ryman is with me, Professor Emeritus. Is that how you pronounce that? You're a guy who likes Latin. So. Yeah. At Emory University School of Business, named one of the 100 people who will change the way the world thinks by Fast Company. And most importantly, for today's purposes, no pun intended, Joey is the author of a book called The Story of Purpose. Also runs a company, I should mention, called Bright House. He gets to think for a living.
Which is great.
So welcome.
Thank you. Thanks, Dana, so much.
Not everybody gets to do that. I think a lot of people would love to be able to just think for a living.
Well, it is an incredible profession that we don't do enough of. And that's why I'm writing the books and lecturing, to help people think a little more.
It's we were talking before we got on the air about purpose and you know, what it means. And one of the things I thought was so interesting about the book, I'm just diving right in, because I feel like I've just been ingesting this book for a couple of weeks, and I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you.
But you talk about purpose, and you use the word authentic. And I know I have experienced a lot of companies who have, you know, a mission statement on the wall, or they have a company meeting and they throw some ideas at you, but it doesn't feel authentic.
Exactly.
So let's talk a little bit about that.
Okay, well, first let's get the lexicon straight, because everybody takes the words mission, vision, and purpose, and they mix them all up. So just for definition's sake, a mission is what we do every day. I get up, I bottle water, I run a radio show, I run a consultancy. That's what I do. A vision is where I'm going. So that might be geography. I might want to be a bigger, better host. I might want to host in many, many different countries. I might want to make 30% more money next year. That's a where. So now we've got a what and a where. But a purpose is a why. And if you have a why, your what becomes bigger, your where, you get to where you want to go faster. It actually drives just about everything. But it's very hard for a company, let alone a person, to identify their why. Why am I here? And that takes thought. That takes thinking. And that takes homework. And that's the power and the path for purposeful companies. Why am I here? The question people need to ask themselves who are in business, which is just about everybody, is if my company were gone tomorrow, what would the world lose? The second question is, how will my company touch and love the world? These are the provocative questions that get us to a why, because at the end of the day, it's not the bottom line that counts. It's the role that your company is playing in the world.
You know what's so interesting? You said that takes thinking, and I agree with you, but you also said the word love, which isn't really something that comes from your brain. And so it's kind of interesting, because I think one of the things that struck me when I was reading the book is that it's about thinking in your brain, certainly, but it's also about what your gut is telling you, what your heart is telling
exactly.
you. Exactly. And I think there's a couple of things we have to lay out. Ground rules.
Okay.
Because, okay, first of all, you talk about this in the book, and I've been saying this forever. Companies are not entities that are just soulless. They are made up of humans. They are made up of people, right? So a company has a personality and a heart and a soul, right? Because all the people who work there do. And one of the things, I'm going to go off on a tangent here, but one of the things that always interests me is when people talk about B2B marketing or B2B sales or whatever, and they say, well, I don't have to do this or that because we're B2B. I don't have to do Twitter, let's say, for example, because we're B2B. But you're still talking to other individuals at another entity, right?
That's correct.
And they're still human beings with a sense of humor, who like new technology, all of those things. And people seem to forget that companies are made of people.
Right. And this whole nomenclature of B2B is fascinating to me, because B2B people become C2C people at home. They go to bed the same way.
Ding, ding, ding.
Right. So we're all C2C. We're all consumers, prosumers, people. You're absolutely right, Dana. Where I see business going is actually not making products and services anymore, but actually making people brighter, making people better, enriching their lives, guiding, inspiring, and actually healing them, which in a hopeless, hapless, and helpless world, we certainly need.
Yeah, so interesting. All right, so when we talk about authentic purpose, let's say, for example, because I know a lot of what you do in your business is go into companies that have been around for a long time and who sort of have maybe lost their way, and sort of help them find their purpose. And so I guess we'll go back to the roots of the book. And you talk about the roots being where they find their purpose.
That's right. The fruits are in the roots.
Yeah. So explain that a little bit.
Yeah. Most companies try to figure out what they ought to be doing by asking the marketplace. But the marketplace has no concept of where you came from, what you want to be, or why you're here. So the work that I do is actually help companies find their why by going to their origins, to their roots, to the instructive spark of fire that actually created their company in the first place, actually gave way to culture and values that wrapped and embraced that culture, and then what I call the black box of strategy, which is that ethos, that culture, and those values, those elements actually drive strategy and tactics versus the other way around. So this is an inside-outside job, that the work of purpose, not asking the marketplace. And this is a sea change in the way that we think about marketing and about business, that it is not about what the consumer wants, but the way that what we can create that helps their needs. It is the first time business is looking at it this way in two centuries.
It's so interesting. I mean, I think there's so many facets to this. I mean, first of all, I think nowadays, because we talked about this a little bit before we came on the air, but there is this concept out there in the business world of a social enterprise, mm-hmm. right? And this is this newish, it's not so new anymore, but what, 5 years old maybe, or mm-hmm. 10, 7, I don't know, concept of these businesses that are out to do good. And for me, a lot of them, my BS meter goes off.
I don't
quite believe it, right? And so, but what you're talking about is not necessarily having a charity that you give a pair of shoes to, right?
No.
Though I don't think there's anything wrong with Tom's, by the way.
Right.
But I think what you're talking about is something deeper. And so explain that. Like, you use some examples like from P&G, from Lego.
Right.
And they're like, Lego's mission isn't necessarily to give half their money to charity, right?
No, but it's to help kids play well,
right.
and not to forget the power of play. And, you know, Dana, you bring up, it's such a great place to talk about. We can go back to companies like Sony. Sony's a great example it's a remarkable little story about purpose. Akio Morita, who was the founder, actually built Sony right after World War II. I mean, Japan was leveled. And his strategist came to him and said, "Mr. Morita, we have a great strategy on how to make you the number one technology company in Japan." And this was a very lengthy meeting. At the end of the meeting, he said, I love everything you said and I want to proceed, but I want to change just a couple words in my purpose statement. I don't want to be the number one technology company in Japan, because look at Japan. We have been leveled. What I want is Japan to become the number one technology country in the world." And with that, it was so inspiring that from the ashes came this amazing company who were focused not just on the next quarter, but the next quarter century for a country that had been leveled. So this is the story of purpose. There are other examples from P&G. My most recent, most favorite example, one that just came to fruition, was around Secret deodorant. I know your listeners know what Secret deodorant is. If you went to Procter & Gamble a decade ago, they'd tell you, well, it's an efficacious deodorant for women. Not very inspiring.
Yeah, that's not sexy at all.
No, not at all. But when they looked at their ethos, when they looked at their beginnings, what I had mentioned earlier, that instructive spark of fire, they found a story. And the story was that in the 50s, when women were moving into the workplace, they wanted their own symbol for whether it be a deodorant or a flag. And the people who created Secret didn't think of it as a deodorant. They thought of it as a flag of women marching into the workplace, of helping women become more fearless. So this notion, this purpose of helping women become more fearless actually took hold again. They found, actually I helped them find a swimmer named Diana Nyad, who had just announced that she was going to swim from Cuba to Florida. And we built a Facebook page, and we watched her swim. Now, for 4 years, she failed. This year, she made it. The important thing about this story is not just that Diana Nyad made it, but that Facebook page actually became the second fastest growing Facebook page on the planet, with 1,600,000 women talking to each other about how they each can become more fearless. So here we have purpose at work, based on ethos, based on authenticity. And you mentioned authenticity. Millennials are built with BS meters. And boomers, or what I endearingly call kaboomers, are looking for a new meaning in their life. That's over 200 million people in our country alone looking for meaning.
You know, it brings up an interesting topic that is, again, a little bit I'm going to deviate from the book just because I'd love to get your thoughts on this. One of the things that's starting to rise up and really irritate the living daylights out of me is, and it's been going on for a long time, but is all this sort of cause marketing.
Right.
And I watched a documentary recently called Pink Ribbons Incorporated. I don't know if you've seen it, but, you know, I'm a breast cancer survivor. And so I think that's what drew me to that particular documentary. But it's so infuriating. And I've always felt this way when a company does something like, for example, a yogurt company says, send this lid in and we'll give a penny to right. breast cancer research. Why don't they just give the money? Why do I have to mail the thing in? And are they using that pink ribbon to get me to buy their yogurt when they're really not doing anything? I don't know. The whole thing just, I find it like, infuriating.
Yeah, Dan, I'm right with you. I gave a talk recently about cause marketing, having the cause but no effect.
Thank you.
And again, this is a problem of being, are we disgenuous or being genuine? And putting a pink lid on a cup or a pink can
or dressing the NFL up in pink.
It does not. It's a nice thought. It's a nice thought. But I would call it more intentional than contributory. And one of the great things about purpose, for those purpose fans out there, is you need two things. You need to have great intention, and then you need to make a contribution, a real contribution.
Yeah.
Contribution, or rather intention without contribution, is impotent. Contribution without intention is blind. You need both intention and contribution.
It's so interesting to me because when you think about a company like Ben & Jerry's, for example, who, you know, were sort of always known for giving back to their community, but yet they did it in such a quiet way.
Right.
That was so like, this is just what we want to do. This is from the core who we are. We want to help our community. We want to help certain people get jobs, all the different kind of things that right. they did over the years. But they never stamped it on the side of their ice cream.
No, but we know the stories.
But we know
it. You're actually bringing it up for all your listeners.
It's so interesting, right? Because I would much rather buy, because they feel authentic to me. And I trust that. And I want to take part in that.
Well, they are authentic. As a matter of fact, when milk prices were going through the roof, they actually decided they'd go outside the Vermont farmers who were their constituency, or people, actually the company that bought them wanted them to, and they said, look at the contract, because we'll buy our company back unless we support our farmers.
Yeah.
So they're the real deal, and actually doing really well with the new marijuana law in Colorado. Actually, their sales are going through the roof. There.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I feel like you can tell the difference now. There's a local restaurant company here called Here to Serve Restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
I love the name. And I have to say, I don't know what their corporate culture is like inside the walls, but every one that I've been in, I've encountered service people who seem to genuinely like where they work and like the company and treat me well.
Wow. Look at that. Imagine that generative ripple effect in all companies.
And I've made an effort to mention them on the radio on more than one occasion because I really believe, like I happened to go to Twist last night, which I mentioned to you, and I had never been there before. I didn't even realize it was part of that same group until
right.
I walked in the door and saw the logo. And then I sort of got a little spark of, oh, okay, we'll see. And sure enough, I mean, I was meeting a girlfriend there. It's a big place. I told the host who I was and who I was meeting, and he was super friendly and looked out for my friend for me, and the waitress was, everybody was great.
What you're describing is the next era after the industrial era called the social era, where people actually find doing good and creating service more important than goods and services.
Yeah.
And that's what we're shifting to.
And we talk about the individual versus the company, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how they're sort of intertwined. And I want to say that I feel like this woman last night at the restaurant who was waiting on my girlfriend and I had a better time because she was giving us good service and we were responding pleasantly. So that was making her job better.
Right.
It's all a positive, you know, cycle.
Yeah. In my marketing class on the first day, because it is marketing, I give all the students the only lesson that's important in marketing, which is, and in marriage, which is to be a friend of their excitement. If you understand that being a friend of their excitement is the most powerful tool that you can use in building a business or building a life, you're going to do just fine. I do want to mention another restaurant, which is very purposeful in Atlanta, because people always ask me, do you have to be Procter & Gamble, Nestle, KPMG in order to have great purpose? I said, actually, no. I'm from New York City. I was jetpacking food when I first moved to Atlanta, because in 84 there was no food in Atlanta. So I would be always jetpacking from Zabar's. And I've always had a problem actually with the deli system in Atlanta, because they're good delis, you know, they're good delis here. But there was really nothing like New York City.
No.
And someone called me and said, Joey, you've got to go see this, go to this place called General Muir. It's a new deli at Emery Point. And I said, okay. You know, I was very cynical about it. I walked in, had some food. It was the best deli food I've had in the world. So I asked the owner, I said, this is the best Jewish. Thank you so much, by the way. Now I'm not going to be jetpacking anymore. I'll come here every day. I'm going to tell my friends about it. And I spoke about them on CNN as an extra and here with Dana. and I said, I got one problem. What's with the name General Muir? That's not a very Jewish name. And the owner said, well, that's actually the ship that took my grandparents over after they escaped concentration camps.
Wow.
And I went, oh, my God. I said, let me tell you, I get paid a lot of money for this. It's free. That story is more delicious and maybe more important than even this food.
Yeah, I got chills.
Yeah, and they and I love that story, and I love those people, and I love that food. And I've been, you know, I just got back from Dubai. I was talking about General Muir in Dubai. So what's happening here, Dana, with the stories that you're telling and I'm telling, people love stories. We're meaning-seeking creatures.
Yeah.
We can live 40 days without water, 4 days without food, or rather 40 days without food and 4 days without water, but we can't live more than 30 seconds without meaning. So stories are the new black.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think you're right. I think, you know, if someone were to read the book, you know, maybe just skim through it or something and read some of these big company examples, mm-hmm. they might think, oh, well, I have to be a big company to take part in this. But again, we obviously talked a lot before we came on the air because one of the things we talked about is that, you know, I run a small company, and which is really just me. and I looked at it just from a personal standpoint. And I think what's also really interesting when we talk about companies being made up of people, that if everybody listening to this, first of all, they should all go out and buy your book. Hello.
Thank you.
But of course, but also, you know, if everybody were to really take that time and look inside their head and heart and come up with their personal purpose, it would be so much easier to align yourself with the right company.
Oh my goodness. Probably the most important thing any student who's looking for a job or anyone in a job that they're not liking could do for themselves.
I'm on a committee for my university. It's like the whatever, President's Council of yada yada, whatever. And I'm on the mentoring committee, and we have this annual meeting coming up. This is my first year being a part of this, so I'll see. I'm not sure where it's going, but I'm really interested because I'm going to go up there, God knows, to in Ithaca, New York, in the dead of winter.
Wow, great place.
I don't know what I'm thinking. And talk to these young women who are undergrads and graduates who are in their senior year, in their last year, about what's next. And they're looking for guidance. And I think it's just going to be so interesting because I have sort of lived the last, I lived the first however many years of my career sort of climbing the ladder and doing what I was supposed to. But the last, however, have been much more driven by what my purpose is.
Yes.
And so it's just going to be really interesting for me to talk to some of these women and see where they're at on that scale.
Well, probably these women have met more tormentors than mentors.
Interesting.
And there are very few. Actually, I'm dividing up leadership now in two camps, tormentors and mentors, because so much of leadership is top down.
Yeah.
But what you're doing, Dana, and what's important for all mentors is to not to push our ideas into these kids, but to pull their ideas out of them, out of their hearts. The
right.
brain may run everything, but the heart runs the brain. And as far as purpose is concerned, you know, my favorite quote as of late is from Mark Twain. He said, the two best days of our lives are the day that we are born and the day we find out why. And I think I'm starting to think that the second might be even more important.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I want to get back to some of the concepts in the book a little bit. Let's talk about the master idea.
Mm-hmm.
Explain what that is.
Okay, so when I opened Bright House, I called it an ideation company. It was the first of its kind, the first use of that word in business. now it's become a bit of a cliche, but my work was in ideating, in thinking. And I learned 3-4 years into my business that some ideas are bigger than others, and I called them master ideas. These are ideas that actually move civilization or move people. In history, Theodore Roszak, actually the late Theodore Roszak, a Berkeley professor, talked about these ideas as God is love, we shall overcome, for better, for worse. These expressions, he said, were not necessarily factual, but at some level, some deep level, they resonated as truths. So I took his work and I started building on it and thought, maybe there are ideas inside businesses that actually were truths, and found that indeed the companies that were living their truth were actually creating more revenue, not just financial revenue, intellectual revenue, and psychological revenue and spiritual revenue. So that's the work that we do now. We look for the master idea within these organizations. Secret was helping women become more fearless. SunTrust is helping you shine every day. Together We Sparkle is this notion at Coke that only when we come together as a community can we be truly holistic, whole, and happy. So every company has one of these. It's not easy to find it, but I lay out in the book a very, very pragmatic, straightforward path on how to find one's purpose.
And I think it also is very interesting that it's not particularly a slogan, though it could be.
Yes.
And also that, again, without authenticity, it's
right.
meaningless.
Yeah, a master idea is a timeless truth. Then the company can create timely acts. But there's only one truth for every company and only one truth for every person. Different actions, they'll change. Strategies will change every week. Tactics will change daily. But your purpose, your why, your truth never changes.
Let's talk about that in the context of two companies, just for grins. And okay. Another word we don't usually say on the radio. But let's look at Lego compared to somebody like Blockbuster, right? I mean, Lego is this company that creates little plastic toys.
Right.
Who went off on a tangent and did some other stuff for a while and sort of lost their way, right?
That's correct.
And then you have Blockbuster, this company who I'm going to assume, since they fell apart, that they didn't really know what their authentic mission was.
Yep, and I still don't know what it is.
But let's say for the sake of argument, well, because they didn't either, obviously, and,
right.
and they therefore failed, right? But so let's say for the sake of this discussion that Blockbuster had looked at their purpose as bringing entertainment to people in their homes.
Right.
Versus selling movies in a store.
Right. And I'd even ask them a deeper question, which is why is that important to bring it to their homes?
Okay.
And that, you know, it's the questions are the new answers today, Dana. And this is what Blockbuster did not do. They did not ask enough questions about why they were here. And as a result, they never had real answers. And when you don't have an answer, somebody else answers for you. In this case, it was the public.
Right.
And they were shut down.
Right.
On the other hand, we've got Lego, which is a love story. Their origins are amazing. It was all actually Lego is Danish for playing well. They were very focused on the power of play, on how we should not lose our childrenness, they called it. And even Piaget, the great psychologist, said that all genius is the retrieval of one's childhood. That's what they're focused on. I like that. I want to be okay with being a child once in a while. And I want to know, I want my imagination, the organ of meaning, to be exercised by taking little things and making bigger things out of them. And that's why a company like Lego will always, at least for the foreseeable future, be prominent in our hearts, and Blockbuster will soon be forgotten.
Yeah, gone. And one of the other things, we're circling around a lot of these topics, which is kind of how I roll.
Good.
But
love it.
I like also one of the things, and I've experienced this. I've both had my own companies and worked as an employee many times, and I have worked for companies where I felt alienated. They had some quote unquote mission or vision or whatever that they were spouting off, whatever,
right.
And I didn't buy it. And one of the things you talk about is the messaging that, again, first of all, it has to be authentic. We've said that 100 times already on this show, but also it has to really address all the stakeholders.
That's correct.
Including the employees.
That's right.
So just talk a little bit about that, because I think there's a lot of people kind of at the top level that forget sometimes that you can't say you're XYZ company if you're treating your employees like crap,
right? Yeah. In the 1970s, there was an economist named Milton Friedman who actually put forth this notion that the reason business is here is for shareholders. And I don't share that philosophy, and I don't think the leaders of businesses today share that philosophy. Clearly, business is in business, not just for shareholders, but for all stakeholders. At Whole Foods, for instance, John Mackey, the CEO, will tell you he has 6 business units. One of them is the earth. And he has to take care of the earth, his employees, his associates, his vendors, and yes, his consumers, but all the same way. They all need to get time. They all need to get visibility. They all need to be touched. And they all need to be served. And this is what the new business is about. It's about a stakeholder mindset that says the world is at stake. We have terror. We've got environmental issues. We've got teetering economies. And worse off, we have a crisis in meaning. So I'm going to start taking care of people. And if I take care of people, if business means not just taking care of business, but taking care of people, I have no doubts that I will succeed in ways that I have never even imagined.
And it's so interesting when you look at Whole Foods because, you know, first of all, it's expensive. And most people don't mind paying.
No, they don't, because they're going there for soul. And I'm not talking about the fish.
Absolutely.
They're going there for the energy that they feel that these people are emoting.
When you go in there, you get a sense that those employees, like I've gone in looking for a particular thing that I can't find. And I found a Whole Foods employee and said, I'm looking for X, Y, or Z. And they don't just point me to an aisle. They take me. They walk with me. They go with me.
And they're genuine.
And they're genuine. If they can't find it, they take me to somebody else who can help me find it. Like, they really do seem to love being there and love their jobs and love me.
Right.
And that's why you go there.
There you go, Dana. Right back to this notion of being a friend of their excitement. Everybody in there is a friend of Dana's excitement, a friend of my excitement, a friend of their excitement. And that is the secret sauce. That's the real food.
And it's really funny because, you know, there's a Kroger right next to my house, basically, right around the corner that's rebuilding. And they're building this brand new, big, fancy Kroger. And I can already tell I'm not going to enjoy being there.
Well, yeah. As far as Kroger is concerned, I actually have heard that they're looking back into their origins, their history. We might be surprised in a couple of years what might happen with Kroger.
I hope so, because honestly, it's the most convenient for me. I would love it to be great. But the thing is, you know, right now, I go to Publix and I have a different experience than I have at Kroger. They don't take care of me the same way at Kroger. I don't feel taken care of there.
Again, the quotient is how friendly are they with me, my excitement?
Right. Very interesting stuff. And while we're talking about company examples, I want to talk a little bit about Delta, because you talk about Delta kind of going back to their roots and having a time of, you know, in bankruptcy, having a time of trouble and sort of rediscovering their roots. And it's so interesting because I remember this is one of those things I just wanted to chat about for funsies. But I remember going, you know, to Delta many times over the years prior to, I think, that. And obviously, I wasn't really engaged in what was happening with Delta at a corporate level, so I'm not sure that I really know when that transition took place. But I will say this. I remember thinking back in the day, ugh, they're so mean. Like Delta, oh, the red coat guys, you know, like, oh, the Delta red coat GMs or whatever, you know, they would come if you were having a problem at the desk or something. And like, they were scary. They were mean. They were not helping me. But a couple of years ago, maybe 2 years ago or a year ago, my daughter and I were trying to go somewhere on Delta. We were meeting up in another city, and she was in Boston. I was here, and there was a big storm. And she couldn't get out of whatever. So I called Delta on the phone, and I got this guy who could not have been better. He was genuinely concerned with my daughter and my situation and where we were trying to go. He asked me to conference her in.
Wow.
So that we could make sure we could all get on the same page and get her where she needed to be so that she could meet me and I could pick her up at the whatever. And I was like, this is a different company.
Absolutely. Actually, Dana, it is the same company as when it started.
Yeah.
It became different over the years, but when it started in Shreveport, in Louisiana in 1928, C.E. Woolman, their founder, talked about the customer the way you are talking about the customer. He was not focused on the altitude of the planes, but the attitude of the people.
Yeah.
And he was very, very focused on what he called lifting the world. And when they found their ethos about lifting the world, that company, and going back, the fruits are in the roots, to their ethos, actually reached altitudes they had never, ever imagined. And there are many stories like yours.
And now I would feel very comfortable. Like, my daughter was, again, about to fly back to Boston this week, and we were worried about the weather. And I was like, without a second thought, I was like, oh, just call them. I'm sure they'll help you, make sure it's okay, and they'll get you on a different flight if you need it. Like, I had no concerns. Whereas 10 years ago, I would have been like, ugh, you're in trouble. Forget it.
Delta is one of the great returns to one's ethos. In fact, if you watch the video of Richard Anderson, who says, hi, I'm Richard Anderson, and I'm standing in front of C.E. Woolman's desk. Well, that is exactly what companies need to do. They unearthed his desk. They unearthed his philosophy. And they set not new coordinates for the future, but old ones from the past that said, you know what? It's all about the person sitting in the seat. It's all about lifting the world geographically. So let's put more roots in, and lifting them psychologically and spiritually. So let's be nice to them. That company is a company working beautifully off their master idea and their purpose.
You know, one of the things that, you know, we talked about all the stakeholders, and But one of the things that you talk about quite a bit in the book is culture. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people, when they hear the word culture as it relates to a business, they think about the work environment. You know, you hear about Google and is there a place to play ping pong and are you going to give me food? And
right.
that's what they think about. But you talk about it in a different context. So explain what culture means.
Well, culture is what we've done every day. It's basically the shared beliefs of the organization. And in my book, culture is the new strategy. If you have a good culture, if people feel safe, if they feel that they won't be fired, that they can fail, that you embrace their ideals and their values, those people will stick by you. They'll also be a lot more productive. And when I say a lot more productive, I'm talking about thousands of percent more productive than someone who's in a job too small for their spirits. So a culture usually run by the human resources person, which I'd like to rename the human resourcefulness person, because human resources should not be a containment policy, but a policy that liberates people to be who they were meant to be.
Yeah.
These are the companies that are actually doing better than the hierarchical companies. And as a matter of fact, last week, Zappos, which I know your listeners know about, they declared that they would become a holacracy, which is they're going to have no leaders, no managers. They're just going to have circles of groups and circles of friends.
All right. So listen, I read that article. In fact, uh-huh. I'm glad you brought it up because I was going to bring it up. And then I thought, but I'm glad you brought it up because I read that article and I have to say, maybe this is my 80s background uh-huh. or whatever, but like my BS meter went up a little bit.
Mine did a little bit too, but I like the idea. And you know why I like the idea? Because companies with a purpose don't need leadership. The purpose is the new boss. If you have a purpose is personal. A purpose provides guardrails for people so they can be themselves as long as the larger organization, the larger system is being supported. I like the idea. Let's see if Zappos works out.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting because there's a fine line in my mind about, you know, like part of me feels like that's like we're bringing back the 60s. We're all going to hold hands and sing Free to Be You and Me or something. But there's something about structure that I feel like is important and knowing that there is someone that can make the decision. And so, yeah, you know, and also like there's also people have aspirations and they want to, in theory, move up in a company.
Right.
And if there's no leadership, how do you move up? And,
well, yeah.
So there's some questions for me.
And then you bring up a great point. I think the idea of moving up actually comes from the structure of the structure. So we have actually provided a structure for business that says you can, if you move up, you're better.
Right.
It might be time for us to ask other questions, like if you move it along, you might do better. If you move it forward or if you move out. But moving up might be an old way, an old measurement system. And remember, we grow the way that we are measured. So it's very important to look at measurement systems within organizations. And one of the great things about purpose, organizations with purpose, is they actually now reward their associates based on how purposeful those associates are. Imagine a company like that. And there are many now that are actually putting in place measurement systems that reward people who are more purposeful.
You know what? I love this because I'm like learning as we talk, which I think is phenomenal. But I think you're really bringing up a really interesting point because one of the problems I think, and we talked a little bit before we went on the air about the Wolf of Wall Street, who had no soul and was just all about making money and moving up, right? And I think, you know, there is a really interesting phenomenon of people who kind of came up in my era, maybe also a little before and a little after, who started moving up. This is what happened to me. I moved up. I got a VP title. I got a director title. I got a whatever. I got more salary. And I looked around and I said, I'm still not happy.
Exactly.
And there is something mentally wrong with the idea of if I just keep moving up, I'll feel better. But the reality is, and I'll maybe get more in touch with what I'm about and I'll make more, I don't know. But the reality is there's a ceiling for everybody. You can only go so far up, right?
I mean,
there's less and less positions the higher you go in a hierarchical
That's
structure.
Correct.
So if you can get joy and you know, feel good about your job by, as you said, maybe doing the best, like let's say you're that Delta customer service agent who maybe really loves dealing with people on the phone and helping them get where they need to go. why shouldn't he be rewarded for that and be able to stay in that job and continue to make more money? And
that's a different structure.
It's a different structure.
And it's a flatter structure and a healthier structure.
Yeah.
You know, people like ourselves, and I'm sure so many of your listeners who've gone to the top of their game, got to the top of their game. For me, when I reached the top of the mountain, if you will, I found what I brought with me, and that's all there is up there.
Yeah.
So sometimes that climb is not really worth it. It might be worthwhile to stay in base camp. Really, because often people are hurt on the way up. There's really nothing up there. If you get there by yourself and you're at the top of the mountain, the view's not very good because you're alone. And what I think I've learned, and a lot of my readers have written back to me, is that they found in the book is that love, that everything else is a consolation prize for love. And it might be better off to focus on those we love and those who love us than trying to love a job that will not love us back.
Right. It's so interesting. And I think this is going to bring me to another little nugget in the book. You talk about idea killers versus idea creators.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this sort of applies when you're thinking about sort of, you talked about people being able to create something in a company and fail.
Right.
I think about this in terms of not just how you help an employee along, but also our kids.
Right.
Right. How we raise our kids and ourselves, how we treat ourselves. And so one of them I think was we don't have the budget.
Right.
That's an idea killer.
Yeah.
And we'll find the budget. That's an idea creator. Right. And so you kind of give this whole list of each.
Right. It's the lens that we look through at work. And there are a lot of cynics out there. Again, cynic is from the Latin, actually means it actually refers to a dog peeing on things. And that's really what I think cynics are: doubters, cynics, skeptics. They're not the crazy ones. They're not the ones that move the world forward. They're not the ones that we aspire to be. And too often, actually, at Bright House, we have a rule. And the rule is no eyeball rolling. This is the ultimate idea killer. And there was a study I read. I wish I remembered the source, but I remember the number. 80% of couples who eyeball roll end in separation and divorce. That's a pretty significant number. It works the same way at work. Ideas are born, nascent ideas are born helpless. They need nurturing. They don't need eyeball rolling. So if an idea comes up and somebody rolls their eyes, that idea is dead.
Yeah.
Or as you said, there's no budget. That idea is dead.
Right.
Or no one would like that. Or that's crazy. Well, those are the ideas that actually make the world come alive.
And the interesting thing is I have found just on a personal level for my own career and sometimes an idea that is crazy and doesn't work is still great because it's the seed for the next idea that does work. Right.
Absolutely.
So if you don't go through the process of doing the one that wasn't quite right and failed, you don't get to the one that is perfect.
Right. Thomas Edison said that the almost 11,000 times he failed at a light bulb were all steps. There was 10,738 steps to creating a light bulb. He never saw anything as a failure. He saw it as just one step closer to his invention.
I do. When I was in the technology field for some time as a programmer, that is sort of how I wrote code. I wrote a line of code. I tested it. Didn't work. I fixed it. I changed something. Tried again. Didn't work. Changed something else. Tried again. Didn't work. And eventually I'd get to the line of code that was the most concise and worked.
Right.
And that is actually literally how the process worked for me. And I'm sure there are a lot of other programmers that could speak to that do the same thing. So if you could apply that idea of just continuing to try and fail and letting your kids try and fail and letting your employees try and fail.
Yeah, and also suggesting that it's not a sprint, or even a marathon, but it's a relay. This is not, you know, we don't live in a lone creator society. The best ideas are not created by an individual person. Michelangelo had 300 painters. Walt Disney had 800 animators. So when one realizes the Sistine Chapel wasn't created by this one man, but by a whole group, it's the same way in business today. Whether you're in technology, healthcare, communications, all great ideas are the result of great collaboration.
So let's wrap up with another big idea.
Okay.
And you talk a lot about alignment, and it sort of relates to what you're saying, this idea of team, and there's 800 people doing this and 500 that. And even if you're a small company, it's only 5 or 10 of you.
Right.
Let's talk about, or two maybe, companies right now who might be listening who are out of alignment. What's a good thing? Like, what's a good first step?
Purpose. And Dana, you bring this notion of alignment is so powerful. You know, companies that have, you need two things or two characteristics in all great companies. One is alignment. Everyone's aligned around one concept, one purpose. And then you need advocacy. People have to believe in it instead of their BS meters going off.
Right.
Now, if you have great advocacy, which happens in companies without purpose, where an autocratic, steely-eyed CEO will say, this is the way it is, and this is how you have to be. You may have great advocacy, but you have no alignment. Or worse yet, you have alignment without advocacy. Advocacy without alignment, there's battles going on all the time. Alignment without advocacy is just a boring company.
Yeah.
But purpose creates both the alignment. Okay, we are all on the same page. And by the way, I am so excited about going to work. I don't have a job too small for my spirit. I'm not in a job. I'm not in a career. I'm in a calling. And it's much cooler to wake up to a calling than it is a job. And for those CEOs out there, it's much cooler to wake up and be excited about going to work than something that keeps you up in the middle of the night. We need to start focusing on what gets us up in the mornings.
I mean, I really think we could keep talking for two more hours. I'm not going to do it to you,
okay.
But I'm loving this.
You're amazing.
I have to say, all my listeners know that about, I don't know, 6-8 months ago, I somehow had just stopped reading business books for quite a long time because I don't know why. I got turned off. Something happened. I don't know. But 6 or 8 months ago, I decided I need to catch up and read all these business books. So over the last 6 to 8 months, I've been reading, you know, Good to Great, lots of, Poke the Box, you know, Seth Godin, Malcolm Gladwell,
yep.
All these guys.
All
Jim
the superstars.
Collins. And I got to say, Joey Ryman, one of my favorite books in the last 6 to 9 months, The Story of Purpose. And I wish I could give a copy to everyone.
Thank you.
I know who runs a company, but really just everyone I know, because I wish I had a bigger budget and I could just, you know, it's not in the budget, Joey, but I really wish I could, because there's so many core concepts in here. I'm going to send everybody back to school at Emory. Maybe that's what I need to do.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. You're incredible. And obviously living a life of purpose, because your passion is remarkable.
Well, thank you. I really, this resonated with me, and I know it's going to resonate with listeners and readers. And I thank you so much for coming in. And I know we'll see lots of each other on future projects.
Thank you so much.
This has been an episode of Good Morning Atlanta on BusinessRadioX.com. Stay tuned for more great programming.